and House Hunsrin's closest ally within the city was Mez Baris's own House Barrison Delarmgo. Both Shakti and Mez Baris had one thing in common, their hatred for House Bayenri. If Duskrin was given the title as Eighth House, Mez Baris would force Shakti's hand from her preferred subterfuge and into a straightforward attack to land her on the ruling council. Matron Preanel will find her seat accordingly, the matron mother explained, as soon as there is an opening. Mez Baris began to ask the obvious question then, and some of the others shifted uncomfortably in their seats at the unexpected proclamation. But the matron mother turned to her left and nodded, and so Sumptu rose from the chair and marched around the table, pointedly behind Matron Mez Baris, and took the vacant seat for the Eighth House. House Bayenri will hold two places on the ruling council. This is your design? An astonished Mez Baris remarked. No, the matron mother curtly answered. So Sumptu is no longer of House Bayenri. Who has she joined? Will she begin her own? If so, the rank is far lower by precedent. By the will of Loth, Daemon Eneshesbernon is hereby reconstituted, the matron mother declared. Daemon, Mez Baris echoed, hardly able to get the name out of her mouth. The cursed House Dewerden, scoffed Matron Jindia Milarn, the youngest drow on the ruling council and easily the most fanatical and rigid in her devotion to Loth. Apostasy! Go and pray, matron, the matron mother coolly replied to Jindia. When you are done, you will select your words more carefully. There is no precedent for this, Matron Mez Baris added. There has been no time like this before, the matron mother replied. You have all heard rumors of Tesabarak's or Lauren's journey to the east. The whispers are true. He goes with the blessing of Loth and empowered in her great spell, the Darkening. We will wage war in the east, on the surface, by the Spider Queen's demand. And we will wage that war in the name of House Dewerden. She paused for a moment to let that sink in around the table. So Sumptu, mistress of Sorcerer, high priestess of the Fane of the Goddess, hereby relinquishes her position as first priestess of House Bayenri to assume the seat as matron of House Dewerden. Even House Bayenri's allied matrons ruffled a bit at this seemingly obvious power play. It is a temporary appointment, the matron mother assured them. In a house that will be formed through a cooperation of the other ruling houses, her patron, for example. She paused and glanced at a door at the side of the room and opened it with a shouted command word. Into the chamber limped a male drow of middle age. He measured his steps and kept his gaze to the floor as he moved to sit at the chair Sosumtu had vacated. To let a male in here, Jindia Milarn said and spat. Are we agreed, Matron Mez Baris? The matron mother said, noting with an obvious grin the curious way in which the matron of Baris and Delarmgo stared at the unexpected newcomer. Do you not recognize your own son?
Tosin, Mez Baris breathed.
And she turned a sharp eye upon Matron Mother Quenthel. But Quenthel matched her glare, and with a wicked grin that Mez Baris could only take as a thinly veiled threat. There was something here, Quenthel's look clearly told Mez Baris, that could embarrass the second matron of Menzo Baranzon and her family. Are we agreed, Matron Mez Baris? The matron mother repeated.
I will pray, was all that Matron Mez Baris would concede at that point.
Yes, do, said the matron mother. All of you. I will accept your accolades when Lady Loth has informed you that I am performing her will. With that, she clapped her hands sharply, bringing the meeting of the ruling council to an abrupt end.
The six non-binary matrons hustled from the room, whispering in small groups regarding the startling turn of events. Quenthel noted that Jindia Malarn only remained away from Mez Barris's side until they reached the door. Quenthel knew those two would confer at length about this. Now they understood why Brigand Eärth patrolled the corridors of the former House Doerden. Now they would complain, but they would take it no farther than that. Not at present, at least, with the darkening imminent, as well as the war it portended. And not until Matron Mez Barris came to fully understand the implications of the unexpected return of Tosin Armgo, her son. House Barris and Del Armgo was not brimming with allies, after all, and a major embarrassment could bring the rest of the city storming their gates.
"It played as you anticipated," Gromph asked the matron mother when she went to him in his room at House Bayenry.
"Of course."
"I would have enjoyed witnessing the expression borne by Matron Mez Barris when her long-lost child entered the chamber."
"You revisited Cusor Lauren?"
"I did," Gromph replied,
though he left out any details, particularly his rather startling revelations concerning the surface elf, Dahlia.
"Tiago has returned with you?"
"No, but he will be along presently, I am confident, along with Sarabelle's or Lauren, who will be his bride."
"Good. He has much to do."
"As weapons master of House Doerden, no doubt," Gromph remarked.
And the matron mother looked at him curiously, then suspiciously, for she had not divulged that little bit of information to him.
"Logic could steer you no other way," the archmage remarked. "Ormon, your seed will supplant Anzarel in the hierarchy of House Bayenry, of course. And I doubt you allowed Tiago those fabulous and ancient items forged by Golthanon, that he might serve as a guard captain or some other meaningless position."
"Well reasoned," the matron mother said,
but her expression revealed that she still thought it too fine a guess.
"And the House Doerden wizard?" Gromph asked innocently.
"You tell me."
"Not Gromph, surely," the archmage said. "I find my platter quite filled enough."
Matron Mother Quenthel stared at him, unblinking.
"To Sabarax or Lauren?"
Gromph answered, nodding with clear resignation at the inevitability of the choice.
"He of the blessing of law,"
the matron mother replied.
"You hinted that he would be the archmage of Cusor Lauren," Gromph reminded.
"A necessary tease. I will not afford Matron Xerath any hopes that she can break fully free of us."
The matron mother paused there and eyed Gromph slyly.
"Does it concern that Tesabarak will return to Menzo Baranzon so soon after finding such glory in the eyes of the Spider Queen?"
"Lolth is a spider," the archmage quipped. "Her eyes can be filled with many such glories, all at the same time."
He wasn't sure, but it didn't seem to Gromph as if his sister was amused.
"I have already told you of my concerns for Tesabarak," Gromph said more seriously. "And those concerns are none."
"We shall see,"
said the matron mother as she took her leave.
"We shall see."
Gromph wore a grave expression until he magically shut the door behind his sister. He'd allow her the illusion of an upper hand. He could afford to, for she clearly had not sorted out that Methil L. Videnvelp was not only imparting memories to her, but was discerning her intent and feeding it back to Gromph. In essence, crafty old Gromph was using the mind flare in the same way Evenel had used Methil to gain an upper hand in the chamber of the ruling council. Quenthel was sharper than she had been before the interactions with the Illithid, perhaps, and surely far more knowledgeable about the ways of Lolth's world. But thus far, at least, She was no Eva now. Not yet. After the ease with which Quenthal had dominated and manipulated Manolan Fay and Gromph at House Fay Branch in the Festival of the Founding, Gromph Bayenry found himself quite glad of that. Chapter 18. A Slight Taste of Revenge. Hanging in his iron cage, Artemis and Trary didn't know what to make of any of it. Something had happened to Dahlia, obviously. Something awful. Something perpetrated by that horrid mind flayer. She wasn't crying about Ephron. She wasn't tight with anger or pacing with excessive anxiety and frustration. She wasn't speaking, not even to answer Artemis and Trary's soft calls. She wasn't looking at him or at anything, it seemed. She was just sitting there, uncaged, unguarded, broken. She had one shackle around her ankle, chained to a metal ball, but it hardly seemed as if her captors needed it.
Dahlia,
he called again as loudly as he dared. He really didn't want to give any of the dark elves moving around the forge any excuse to walk over and beat him some more. Not that they really needed an excuse. Many paused to and from their respective forges to stick him with a small knife or a heated poker, or to toss some hot ash up toward his face just to see him try reflexively and futilely to turn away. The woman made no movement to indicate that she had heard him, or even that she cared to listen in any case. She was broken. Perhaps beyond repair, he realized, and he couldn't deny, as much as he wanted to, that the thought of Dahlia's grim fate gnawed at him. Gnawed at him and tugged at his heartstrings more than he ever could have imagined. Knowing where this would inevitably lead, and Trary tried to block out the train of thought, but he could not. In his memories, he saw Callahay again, and he imagined her in Dahlia's place. She too had been taken by the Dark Elves, by Jarlaxle's band of Break in the Earth. Taken from him. Had he really loved Callahay? To this day he wondered, and for this man, who for most of his life was certain that love did not exist, the conundrum truly echoed through his thoughts. Perhaps he had loved Callahay. Perhaps not. But surely his relationship with her was the closest he had ever come to knowing love. Until now. Until Dahlia. And Trary stared down at her from his cage. This could not stand. Very slowly and deliberately, and Trary manipulated his shoulders, twisting and turning and flexing the powerful muscles along his side until his left shoulder blade had moved downward, in effect shortening his arm. More turning and twisting and stretching at last brought his left hand into view. He noted his exceptionally long thumbnail. He kept it that way on purpose. He grimaced with a last painful twist, turning his arm practically out of its socket so that he could turn it in around the outside of the cage and bring that fingernail to his mouth. He sucked that thumb for some time, softening the nail with his spit. Then he bit and slowly peeled, taking the top of the fingernail in one long strip. Activity in the room forced him to twist the arm aside before he could put that nail back into his hand, so he used his tongue to tuck it deep to the side of his lower gum, out of sight, and leaving his tongue clear in case he needed to speak. Out of the tunnel that led to the primordial pit floated High Priestess Berylip, sitting comfortably on a magically glowing summon disc. And Trary thought that surely meant he was in for another round of torture. But that diminished quickly when more notable drow came out of the tunnel right behind Berylip, including Tiago Bayenry and the other Zor-Lauren priestess in the second rank, followed closely by the house wizard and weapons master, the priestess upon a similar floating disc, the males all riding battle lizards. And many others followed, all outfitted for battle clearly, and with a contingent of driders bringing up the back of the long line. and Treri considered their course and traced them back to the chamber that had become, he had heard in whispers, the chapel of this new drow settlement. They had come forth with Lolth's blessing, then, and had come forth prepared to go to war. They were marching out of Gontalgrim again, and Treri realized, as they had gone to port last. More prisoners, more slaves, more dead, more blood. It was the drow way. They came very near to his cage and to Dalia, and Berilip halted the march with an upraised hand and guided her disk to the side, hovering near the broken elf woman.
"Darthea," she said with a sneer and shake of her head. "Know that I would pull your limbs off on the rack were it my choice, and I would keep you alive and find more ways to wound you. I would give you hope, and then I would feed you to Eurynine, and I would watch with joy the unspeakable things he would do to you for killing his beloved Flavar."
"Priestess," Jarth dared to interrupt,
and Berilip turned a sharp stare upon him. She didn't look at him for long, though, and Treri noted, but settled her glower at the male sitting beside her sister, the warrior and Treri knew to be Tiago Beenry. A large bit of bluster left Berilip's features as she matched stares with the noble of House Beenry. The archmage had told her to leave Dalia alone, and Treri realized from that silent exchange. From his time in Menzo Baranzon, and Treri knew well that few would dare cross Gromf Beenry. Even Jarlaxle offered that dangerous wizard more than a bit of deference. Despite the tight press of the cage, Entreri managed to cock his head to the side just a bit with curiosity. The Archmage and House Beenry were protecting Dalia. The second disc floated closer to him.
"You should force Eurynine to come with us," the younger Zorlaren priestess said to Berilip. "He is grieving. I did not know that Dryders were possessed of such emotions," Berilip answered. "He hates the Darthea above all others." "He will not disobey me," Berilip assured her. "Go now to the glory of Cusor Lauren. Return to me with the head of Driz Doerden."
Him again. After the initial shock, Entreri found an epiphany. None of this was coincidence. He and his friends had not been misfortunate in being in port last when the drow had attacked. Nay, the drow had attacked because he and his friends had been in port last. They were still obsessed with Drizzt after all these years. Were they keeping Dalia alive as bait then? That thought hit Entreri almost humorously as he recalled the last bloody meeting between Dalia and Drizzt. Almost humorously. For in his current predicament, he really couldn't find humor in much of anything. Below him, Berilip waved her sister back to Tiago's side, then motioned for the procession to be on its way. The force moved by swiftly and steadily, exiting the forge in short order. Entreri hung motionless and expressionless, trying not to stare too intently at Berilip and Dalia, trying to seem as if he was far beyond any concerns of the world about him, too walled up within his own pain and misery. Indeed, he showed no interest at all, and showed himself to be too beaten and broken to even care. But he cared indeed. By his estimation, well over half of the Zorlaren garrison had just departed the complex, and with all of the nobles save Berilip, a good portion of the Goblinkin slave force, and many of the monstrous Dryders with them. He would get his chance. The forge lay quiet, the stillness interrupted only by the occasional ping of the hammer of the lone drow blacksmith still at work and the snorts and chortles of sleeping slaves. Dalia, too, was fast asleep, lying on the stone floor right in front of Entreri's cage. The assassin used her as his focus, staring at her, thinking of what these wretched dark elves had done to her and what they would likely do to her going forward. He focused on that as his one hand reached up and worked deliberately, fingernail in hand, on the tumblers within the cage's lock. And Treri had contorted himself enough to stick a finger from his other hand into his ear, blocking the sound, while he rested his open ear against the same metal bar that ran up to the lock. He heard and felt the subtle vibration as a tumbler clicked. Nothing mattered to him beyond that sound, then. With perfect concentration, the skilled assassin tuned all of his senses to his work, feeling and learning the intricate mechanism, listening for the telltale sounds. A second tumbler was soon defeated, and Trary fell deeper into his trance, blocking out all distractions, pure focus. Click went the third, then the fourth. And then came an unexpected sound indeed, as the lock opened and the leaning assassin inadvertently pressed the door open just a bit, just enough to set off a lightning glyph that crackled about him, stinging him painfully and alerting those in the room. He dropped his arms and hung there, seeming unconscious, but still the drow blacksmith approached, hot poker in hand. The drow called out as he did, and another pair of dark elves ran into the room from the corridor beyond, rushing to join their kin. They came up to Entreri, glancing about nervously. The cage door moved imperceptibly, and another shock rattled the assassin. He groaned and lolled his head to the side. He understood the drow language enough to recognize the obvious question, and he did well to hide his smile at the answer.
His weight has loosened the door enough to set off Priestess Berylip's traps.
Entreri unclenched his muscles enough for his weight to shift the door the tiniest bit yet again, to jolt him with magical lightning yet again. He groaned. The dark elves laughed. The two guards were still laughing when they went back to their posts. The blacksmith was still laughing when he lifted his hammer once again. Entreri let the cage shock him again, and several more times after that, at varying intervals and for varying periods of time, sometimes through several painful heartbeats. The blacksmith stopped even looking back his way. The cage sounded again for a long while, then fell silent as Entreri, on the floor, quietly closed the door. Dahlia sprawled before him, and how he wanted to go to her. He slithered off into the shadows instead, crawling by the sleeping goblins, where he appropriated a long shovel. Like a whisper of wind he moved, forge to forge, shadow to shadow, pile to pile. None were better at hearing the quiet than the drow, but none were better at being the quiet than Artemis Entreri. He came up behind the drow craftsman, leaning the shovel diagonally against the tray of the workplace. In one fluid movement, Entreri stepped up beside his intended victim, lifted the hot poker, and brought it in against the drow's belly. The shocked blacksmith instinctively threw his hips back, and Entreri helped him avoid the press of the poker by grabbing the hair at the back of the drow's head and driving forward with all his strength. Already bending forward to avoid the poker, the surprised blacksmith offered little resistance as Entreri slammed his face down on the edge of the metal tray in front of him. Up came the dazed and bleeding dark elf to Entreri's strong pull, and down he went again, even harder. Entreri kicked down hard on the leaning shovel, cracking the handle in half, and before the broken top piece could fall, he snatched it out of the air with his free hand. The drow craftsman finally reoriented himself enough to start to call out, but around came Entreri's arm and makeshift weapon, the now sharp end of the broken handle stabbing up under the drow's jaw and stealing his words in a gurgle of erupting blood. A third face slam had the craftsman falling limp, barely conscious. Still holding him fast by the hair, Entreri set down the spear and drove his free hand up against the drow's crotch. With the strength of a warrior, muscles hardened by decades of fighting, Entreri hoisted his victim from the ground and tossed him into the oven, feeding the forge with drow flesh. Primordial fire ate the poor drow immediately, consuming flesh and charring bones before he could even truly cry out. Still, the dying dark elf issued enough of a sound to remind Entreri that he had to move fast. He slid the halves of the broken shovel back together, using the splinters of the wood to make the piece appear whole at a cursory glance. He noted a narrow nail on the tray and collected it, thinking it a far better lockpick than a thumbnail after all. Then he quickly dabbled some ash on the floor at the base of the forge and rushed off into the shadows, crossing by the sleeping goblins just long enough to replace the shovel among their utensils. Back at his cage, he accepted another painful sting of the lightning glyph as he swung the door open and leaped back into place, then shut the door with his arms and shoulders positioned carefully to make it look as if it had never opened. He twisted around and reached up, using his new and better lockpick to engage one of the tumblers before setting it into his mouth, tight beside his gums. The assassin fully relaxed and fell back into place. He leaned his face on the iron band and cried out suddenly, sharply, and very briefly, just enough to stir the goblins and to alert the guards outside the room. And then he appeared to be, to all who might look, no more alive than the monk in the cage beside him, hanging limply against the press of the cage. Just a heartbeat later, and Treri noted one goblin standing and looking around curiously. The creature kicked another nearby sleeper, and so on down the line, until several were up and about, scratching their ugly heads and pointing to the still-fired forge where the drow had been at work. The group moved there, filling the ash and Treri had sprinkled with their footprints, and looked all around until one of them noted the charred remains inside the oven. Then how they jumped, falling all over each other to get away from the murder scene. They scrambled and went for their tools, makeshift weapons to use against whatever intruder had murdered the drow craftsman. In came the dark elf guards at the sound of the commotion, and when shown the murder scene, they called in many more. Watching through one half-closed eye, Artemis and Treri enjoyed the spectacle indeed, as the drow demanded answers from the goblins. He had only one moment of fear, when the goblins pointed to Dahlia, gibbering that she must be the culprit. It was precisely that moment, however, when one of the ugly little creatures lifted the shovel and Treri had borrowed. It noted the stains on the handle only then, and when it moved to inspect the blood, the shovel fell in half, revealing the makeshift spear, leaving the goblin holding the murder weapon, and with goblin footprints all around the ash near the crime scene. The goblins kept pointing at Dahlia, who seemed unaware of anything going on around her, but the dark elves ignored them, and beat them, and stabbed them, and threw them into the oven one by one. And Treri did well to keep a wry smile off his face as he watched the unfolding massacre. It had been a good night's work.
"Take her and flee," and Treri heard a drow call out to another. The assassin's thoughts whirled, for they were speaking of Dahlia, obviously, and the nearest two drow, a male soldier and a priestess, rushed for her. And Treri rolled his lockpick around in his mouth, thinking he might need to put it to quick use. Something was happening, some excitement, some tension. Might he use this sudden distraction to break free and be away? He looked at Dahlia and winced. She seemed hardly aware of the rising tensions. She just sat there, her expression void. He didn't think he could convince her to flee beside him, and if he had to drag her along, he knew he could never escape the drow. His eyes scanned upward to the approaching dark elves, and he steeled his resolve. Perhaps he wouldn't escape, but he'd surely take a few drow to the grave beside him. His confusion increased a moment later when the source of the tumult came into view in the form of a huge drider.
"You are supposed to be with Princess Sarabel," one drow screamed at him.
"Silence!" the drider, and Treri had heard this one called Eurynine before, growled back.
"Where is the vile Darthir?"
"She is not your concern," said the priestess then standing over Dahlia.
"On the word of Priestess Berylip."
Obviously spotting Dahlia, the drider approached, eight spider legs scratching the stone floor, a heavy mace swinging easily at the end of one of his huge, muscled arms. And Treri knew that mace, Skullcrusher, was the weapon of Ambergris, and he allowed himself just a heartbeat of grief at the loss of the fine dwarf. Just a heartbeat, though, as he tried to sort out his movements. He would exit that cage and rush to the nearest forge to secure a weapon, then...
"Eurynine!"
he heard, and he knew the voice. As did the drider, obviously, for the behemoth stopped and swung around to face the speaker, Priestess Berylip, as she rushed to stand before him and between him and the captive Dahlia.
"The Darthir lives at the suffrage of Archmage Grumph," Berylip said.
Eurynome offered a low growl in response.
You know what he will do to you, Barilip warned,
and when Eurynome continued to lean forward aggressively, she added,
You have met his companion.
It struck Entreri profoundly that the mere mention of a mind flayer could so diminish a creature so obviously powerful as this one. The drider backed off, the blood draining from its drow face.
I have not forgotten you, murderess!
The drider roared at Dahlia, and it lifted its club, and as Barilip yelled for him to halt, Eurynome swung anyway, but not at Dahlia. Skullcrusher slammed the side of Entreri's cage with bone-rattling force, stinging the surprised man profoundly and sending his prison into a wild, spinning swing. Before Entreri could even register the hit, and the sheer power of it awed him, the cage was struck again, and Barilip was cheering along with all the other drow and goblins in the room.
"Take this one out, that I might feast upon his beating heart before the eyes of the Dothir,"
the vile drider begged.
"Do not kill him," Barilip intervened. "Not yet.
I will pull off his arms then and just eat those."
Barilip began to laugh, and Entreri thought the hour of his doom was surely upon him. And once more his thoughts began focusing on how he could cause the most devastation before his inevitable demise.
"I do want his arms intact," Barilip replied to Eurynome. "Maybe just one leg."
And Dahlia began to laugh. Entreri looked at her incredulously as each spin of his cage flashed her into his view, and he noted that he wasn't the only one gawking at her.
"Yes, a leg," Dahlia said, giddily. "Like a farmer's plucked chicken."
A long while passed, and the cage settled back to its original position, leaving Entreri to stare at Dahlia and at the stupefied Eurynome, who stood perfectly still, mace held sidelong as if he meant to hit the cage again.
"Well, that is an interesting turn," Barilip whispered.
"I promise you that I will avenge Flavar,"
the drider said, moving its sneering face very close to Dahlia, who stared back at him blankly, as if she had no idea what he might be speaking of. Barilip motioned to the drow soldier and priestess who had been first on the scene.
"Take her,"
she instructed, and her fingers flashed some message to them that Entreri could not make out, likely the location she had in mind. The assassin did share a parting gaze with Dahlia, but he could not tell if her expression was one of sympathy, antipathy, or utter disinterest. The dark elves hustled her away, the male carting the metal ball, the female all but holding up the unsteady Dahlia, and Barilip waved the other onlookers back to their duties.
"If it was my choice," she lamented to Eurynome.
The drider nodded and turned its angry glare back over Entreri.
"One more,"
Barilip offered, and the drider took up Skullcrusher in both arms and rattled Entreri's cage and rattled Entreri's bones. The assassin had been hit by the club of a giant before, almost squarely, but this was something even beyond that experience. By the time the cage had stopped its wild swings and spins, Barilip and Eurynome had moved away. The cage settled fully again, but Entreri could not. His side ached, his hips seemed as if on fire, and he could only hope that there were no serious wounds. He would have to get out of this cage very soon. Chapter 19 Half a Monster.
"Too much,"
Regis lamented. In the commotion, he had inadvertently dumped the whole vial onto the mithril head of Aegis Fang.
"Too much?"
Wolfgar asked frantically when the room's opposite door banged open, a host of goblinkin appearing.
"Just throw it,"
the halfling cried, and Wolfgar was already moving to do just that.
"Tempus!"
the barbarian bellowed, spinning the warhammer end over end at the far wall, the open door, and the bugbear standing within its frame. The hammer struck with the power of an Elminster-inspired evocation, the halfling's bath of oil of impact exploding in a great and concussive fireball. The bugbear flew away, as did its companions huddling in the shadows behind it, as did the door itself, blown from its hinges to somersault off to the side of the room, trailing flames with every bouncing tumble. The door frame collapsed, stone crumbling and bouncing down. The floor groaned, the ceiling groaned. "Get out!" Regis cried, pushing Wolfgar back to the door through which they had entered. "My hammer!" he yelled back, and on cue Aegis Fang reappeared in his grasp, undamaged, indeed unmarked by the blast. Out into the hall the pair scrambled, the room collapsing behind them with a thunderous tremor and roar, and blasts of dust and small stones flying to pelt them. "What did you do?" a startled Wolfgar asked.
"I want to make crossbow bolts like the ones Catterly used to use," Regis explained. "Do you recall? They would collapse on themselves as they hit."
Wolfgar just sighed, for before he could answer, a door farther along the corridor burst open and more goblins spilled out. Side by side, Wolfgar and Regis met their charge, the barbarian a half-step before the halfling, sweeping monsters aside with every great swipe of Aegis Fang, while Regis darted in behind each stroke, his rapier flashing against the disoriented and staggering goblins. Three were down, then five, and when a hobgoblin in the third rank began barking orders, Regis warped step to its side and promptly silenced it. Recognizing the maneuver, Wolfgar pushed on before the halfling had even reappeared, and as soon as Regis struck, his rapier sliding under the side of the hobgoblin's skull, the barbarian caught the halfling by the shoulder and hauled him back. He needn't have bothered. Their leader so abruptly cut down, the smaller goblins scattered, falling all over each other to be away from the murderous duo. Some fled back through the door, while others ran farther down the corridor, only to be met by Drizzt and Brunner coming back the other way, rounding from the left where this corridor ended in a T-junction. Caught between two powerful pairs, the goblins scrambled for the lone open door, creating a tight grouping in the hall before it. A ball of flame appeared in the air, roiling for just a heartbeat before suddenly striking a line of killing blaze down in the midst of that group. And on came Wolfgar and Regis from the south, and on came Brunner and Drizzt, Catty Bree right behind them from the north, the vice closing, the goblins dying.
"What was that explosion?" Drizzt asked when they had joined together once more.
Wolfgar looked to Regis, who shrugged and replied,
"Oil of impact, a healthy batch."
"Ye shook the place to its roots,"
Brunner said, trying to sound stern, but unable to hide his grin.
"Ye wantin' to tell everything in the place where we be?"
Somewhere back behind them, Guinevar roared. Drizzt motioned for Wolfgar and Regis to chase the goblins that had retreated through the door. Then he and the other two sprinted back to the end of the corridor and disappeared to the right.
"Once I didn't hit hard enough, and now I fear I hit too hard,"
Regis lamented.
"Too hard,"
Wolfgar laughed.
"No such thing, my friend, no such thing."
And off they went, side by side, a rambling catastrophe.
"Ye sure we're meeting up with them then?"
Brunner asked, and he lifted his axe up high, tucked his shoulder under his buckler, and charged at the next door in line.
"The two courses are side-by-side runs to the same corridor," Drizzt assured him, and up came Tolmeril.
"Now, girl," Brunner roared, and even as he finished, the lightning bolt sizzled past him, cracking into the ancient wood, followed immediately by Drizzt's lightning arrow, similarly driving against the door's planks. Brunner hit the portal right behind the bolts, axe splintering wood, and his lowered shoulder pounding through. He crashed to the floor by design, and the two enemies in the room, a pair of hobgoblins, eagerly leaped at the prone form. Guinevar leaped over him first, though, flying through the broken portal, touching down in the room just long enough to spring again into the face of one of the hobgoblins, sending it flying backward. The other hobgoblin made the mistake of glancing back at its tumbling friend. It turned back just in time to see another enemy leap in over the dwarf. Just in time to see the deadly drow touch down just a stride away. Just in time to see a pair of magnificent scimitar cutting an X before its eyes, cutting an X across its face. "I'm calling half that kill as me own," Brunner roared, running past Drizzt and sending a backhand chop into the hobgoblin's side for good measure.
He rambled up to the door directly across the room and kicked it open, revealing a long corridor lined on the right side by a multitude of doors.
"Not liking that," Brunner declared.
He glanced back to see Catty Bree close behind. She took a quick survey of the corridor, then began spellcasting, and Brunner moved aside. A wall of fire reached out from her, rushing down the corridor, splitting it down the middle. The flames roiled and roared, but all seemed to be biting out to the right toward the doors.
"Stay left," she explained.
Brunner started in hesitantly, for even though the magical flames of the wall were directional, burning away from him, he couldn't deny the heat.
"Liked ye better with a damned bow," he muttered, sliding along the wall as quickly as he could.
The group eased its way along. At least one door did open, and a goblin shrieked and fell back when faced with Catty Bree's fiery wall. Drizzt turned and fired off a series of arrows into the roiling flames in the direction of the sound, and from a distant cry, it seemed clear that at least one had gone through the open door and struck home. They reached the far end of the corridor, which forked right and turned left and paused there, turning back. Catty Bree dropped her wall of fire, and sure enough, stubborn goblinkin came rushing out, though many foolishly turning the other way, back the way the companions had come. Drizzt put some shots down the corridor, and Guinevar roared. Goblins turned, and goblins died, Tolmaril's arrows driving through them two or three at a time. Some came on into the fury of Guinevar and Brunner, but most scrambled back into the side rooms. One goblin almost got a stab at Brunner with its spear before Drizzt blew it dead into the ground. Almost. Aegis Fang spun end over end, blasted through the bugbear's shield, and struck it dead, simply dead.
"Lots of fighting to the side," Regis called to his companion.
Wulfgar nodded, for he too could hear the lightning strokes and the roar of Guinevar and of magical fires. Drizzt had anticipated that his course would be through more populated areas of the goblin nest, which was why he kept the bulk of the force beside him. For Wulfgar and Regis, the run had been much clearer, with only a few enemies here and there, and most of those more intent on running away than in coming in to fight. The pair weaved around the dead bugbear, Aegis Fang returning to Wulfgar's hand. Under an archway, they came into a wide corridor, running diagonally behind them to the left or forward to the right toward their friends. They went right, trotting along, but a portion of the right-hand wall ahead of them slid aside and out scrambled a group of hobgoblins. Wulfgar wasted no time in sending Aegis Fang flying devastatingly into their midst.
"Let them come to us," Wulfgar bade him, and he glanced at his halfling companion to see Regis with his hand crossbow leveled.
The hobgoblins regrouped and charged, the nearest catching a quarrel in the face. Regis dropped his bow and lifted a ceramic jar from his pouch.
"Let them come to us," he reiterated,
and he held his throw a bit longer, then flung the jug. It smashed to the floor at the feet of the charging monsters. Shards and liquid burst forth, splattering the stone and the feet of the hobgoblins. And that liquid, Regis's next trick, slicked the floor as surely as water thrown on stones on an Icewind Dale's winter night. Like floating seaweed in an irresistible wave, the hobgoblins pitched and crashed, tangled into each other and spilled to the floor. Wulfgar went up to the edge of the greasy splash and pounded down at the tangle with heavy hits of Aegis Fang, the warhammer shattering shields and bones, crushing through feeble hobgoblin armor. Regis rushed up beside him and seemed to simply disappear, warp-stepping across the slippery splash zone, stepping back securely and stabbing ahead before the surprised hobgoblins in the back of the tangle even realized he was there. He scored a series of hits, most on one unfortunate creature that spun down, spurting blood from a dozen holes. The remaining creatures ran off, and Regis turned to follow. He thought his friends had joined him when he saw that group of hobgoblins collectively shudder, one monster flying up to crunch heavily into the wall, another sailing back the way it had come, bowling aside its companions to fall in the middle of the corridor, only a few steps down from Regis, where it convulsed and twitched in its death throes. With a glance back, confident that Wulfgar had the tangled enemies caught in the grease trap well in hand, Regis started along, taking only a couple of steps before he spotted the devastating dwarf among the hobgoblins.
"Brunner!" he called.
But even as he spoke the name, he realized that it was not Brunner.
It was Thibeldorf Puente. The bone in Brunner's finger was surely broken, the digit sticking out at an odd angle. "Clench your teeth," Catibree instructed, and when the dwarf bit down, she popped the finger back into place, then immediately cast a minor healing spell, the blue mist of her magic rolling out of her sleeve and wrapping around the tough dwarf's hand. "My magic is nearly exhausted this day," she told Brunner and Drizzt, "both arcane and divine."
"Bah! But we got along in the last life without it, and so we'll do again," Brunner replied.
In response, Catibree pressed just a bit on the wound she had healed in the dwarf's back, where Brunner had previously caught the bugbear's spear. Brunner grimaced and winced and pulled away, then glared at the girl, silently admitting that her point had been made.
"Give her the bow, elf," Brunner suggested.
Drizzt nodded and reached out with Tolmeril, but the woman recoiled. "I don't even know if I can wield it anymore," she said. "I have never shot a bow in this new life. I have not trained my body."
"You'll get it back then," Brunner insisted, and he pulled the bow from Drizzt's hand and gave it over to Catibree.
"I've some tricks left with my magic," Catibree said, taking the weapon tentatively and then slinging the offered quiver over her shoulder.
"Well, use them as ye can, and use the bow when ye can't," said Brunner, settling it, and the dwarf started off once more, shaking out his hand, then taking up his axe.
Drizzt looked to Catibree questioningly, and the woman just shrugged in reply. The drow pointed to the room's door, broken in and hanging by one hinge. Catibree lifted Tolmeril and set an arrow, leveling the bow. She took a deep breath to steady herself as she drew back, but then eased the string back to resting and offered a plaintive look at the drow.
"Go ahead," Drizzt coaxed. "You have an unlimited supply of arrows."
Catibree closed her eyes and drew back once more, took a deep breath and held it, set her sights and let fly. The lightning arrow shot off, the bright streak lighting the room with its flash, and hit the door dead center, splintering the wood.
"Well then, looking to me like he ain't lost a thing," Brunner cheered, and again he started off. "Right in the heart, as the bow's name says."
Drizzt, too, smiled and congratulated the woman, albeit silently. Catibree just returned that look and nodded. She didn't bother mentioning to either of her companions that she had aimed for the hinge, not the center. Before they had even exited the room's far door, the trio heard the sound of renewed fighting echoing along the corridors and knew that their companions had engaged goblins once more. Guinevere, who had gone out the other way in pursuit of one fleeing goblin, apparently heard it too. The cat bounded back into the room and leaped over the dwarf to take the lead. Regis grimaced in revulsion as he watched as Puente bit out the throat of a hobgoblin. The dwarf glanced up at him, smiled weirdly, and tossed the convulsing monster aside, with ease. With such ease. Puente had hardly swung his arm out, it seemed, and just that one arm. Yet the hobgoblin, thick and heavy, flew across the corridor to crunch into the wall with bone-shattering impact.
"Well met, Thibeldorf Puente,"
Regis announced as enthusiastically as he could manage, past the lump of fear welling in his throat.
"Here, ye little rat thief,"
the dwarf muttered, stalking forward slowly, casually even.
"Puente, it's me," Regis cried. "Don't you know me?"
"Oh, I'm knowing ye," the dwarf said.
Regis got the feeling that the dwarf was not specifically referring to Regis, who was, of course, long dead in Puente's thoughts. The vampire walked forward. Regis lifted his rapier.
"Puente!" he cried. "It's me, Regis!"
He almost finished stating his name when the undead dwarf rushed up suddenly, so suddenly, seeming almost to warp-step himself, much as the specter of Ebensole had done. Regis cried out and dived aside, and still got clipped by a swinging arm and sent tumbling. As he fell aside, Regis reached back with his dirk hand to fend the dwarf away. But the dwarf's spiked gauntlet dug a line across the back of that hand, and the halfling retracted with a yelp.
He pulled himself to his knees and wheeled back as quickly as he could, turning some semblance of a defensive posture at the closing point. Though what he might do against one so powerful and heavily armed as this, he did not know. Puent leaped at him, fangs bared, fists punching in from out wide, and Regis cried out, thinking himself surely doomed. But Puent never got there, intercepted in mid-leap by a spinning warhammer that drove him aside and sent him staggering back down the corridor. He turned immediately, though, his hateful gaze still focused squarely on Regis, and with a feral growl that froze the marrow in Regis's bones, he charged. The halfling yelped again and flung his remaining snake at the vampire. The living garrote did its magic, racing up and around the dwarf's neck, and the sneering undead specter's face appeared over Puent's shoulder, tugging hard. But the vampire didn't draw breath. The vampire didn't even seem to notice. Again the halfling was saved by a missile, this time a living one, as Wulfgar leaped past Regis to crash heavily into Puent. The dwarf tried to hit him with a left hook, but Wulfgar caught him by the arm, then grabbed Puent's right arm as well, holding and twisting. The two powerful combatants locked and strained. At first Puent, with the lower center, seemed to gain the upper hand, with Wulfgar sliding backward under the dwarf's ferocious press. Wulfgar growled his god's name and drove on with renewed strength, halting the momentum. Puent twisted to the side and Wulfgar had to turn with him, struggling to hang on as the dwarf tried to pull away. But then Wulfgar leaped the same way as the pull and Puent overbalanced. Wulfgar let go of the dwarf's left arm and chopped a short right cross into the dwarf's face, but then grabbed back quickly before the dwarf could counter with a left. Regis wanted to cheer that strike, but like the garrote tugging around his neck, Puent didn't seem the least bit hurt or stunned or slowed. And it was Wulfgar showing the cost of their struggle, Regis saw, for the barbarian's hands dripped blood, his flesh tearing against the dwarf's ridged arm plates. Puent ducked his head, dipping his helmet spike, and bore forward, and Wulfgar barely avoided getting stabbed in the face. Then he too bowed forward, tucking his head against the dwarf's helm to maintain the clench. He had to keep Puent in his grasp, he knew. Puent! Thibbledorf Puent, it's Regis and Wulfgar, you know us, the halfling cried, trying to reason with the snarling vampire. He rose as he shouted and ran around to the side, and when Puent didn't react at all to his call, Regis grimaced and stabbed hard. The vampire howled, in pain or in anger, and went into a wild struggle, arms flailing, head whipping around. Wulfgar tried to hold on, tried to stay too close for Puent to cause any real damage. "Stab him!" the barbarian cried, his last word cut short as the dwarf managed to get his helm away from Wulfgar's head just enough to butt it back in hard to the side, cracking against Wulfgar's jaw. Regis struck Puent again, but the dwarf growled it away and whipped around, sending Wulfgar skidding across between himself and the halfling to crash across Regis's arms and drive him back. Wulfgar was out of the way immediately, but not of his own accord, for while the clench was tiring him, the vampire knew no such limitations. Suddenly Wulfgar went flying back the other way, Puent turning to slam him hard into the wall, and then out Wulfgar flew back again, the furious dwarf throwing him at Regis. Regis reflexively ducked, and Wulfgar crashed into the wall behind him.
Puent! Came another shout, this time from Brunner, who appeared farther along the corridor. You know me, Puent! Ye give me back me helm!
That gave the vampire pause, and so did Guinevere, leaping over Brunner and charging right in. But Puent became a cloud of gas, and the panther skidded through, right past Regis and Wulfgar behind him. The gas reformed almost immediately, but now Drizzt came in, rushing past Brunner.
I left you in a cave, brave friend, the drow cried.
Aye, and you're a fool for it,
the vampire shouted back, and he threw himself at the drow, a barrage of punches meeting a flurry of scimitar parries.
Puent!
Brunner screamed. Finally it seemed to get through to the vampire, a bit at least, and he abruptly disengaged from Drizzt and stepped back past Regis, who held his strike. But Wulfgar did not.
Aegis Fang back in his hand, the barbarian cried out and swept the weapon across, smashing Puente in the chest and sending him skidding farther along. Wulfgar jumped out into the center of the corridor and pulled Regis defensively behind him. Then Drizzt rushed up, shoulder to shoulder with the barbarian.
"Puente, ye know us,"
Brunner said, rushing up beside Regis and behind Drizzt.
"We come to help ye."
The vampire growled. Behind the vampire, Guinevere growled.
"Puente, my old friend, remember the fight in the primordial pit," Drizzt coaxed. "You saved us that day. You saved all in the region from another cataclysm."
The vampire looked at him, clearly struggling, memories battling demons within.
"Aye. And I damned meself,"
he replied, his voice shaking with every syllable.
"In the cave," Drizzt said. "The sun."
"Couldn't,"
Puente answered weakly, and he trembled, his eyes darting all around. He was thinking of escaping, they all realized, but only for a moment before he grunted and stood straight once more, glaring at them hatefully and also, strangely, plaintively.
"Finish me, then,"
he roared, and he came forward a step as if to renew the fighting. But he stopped short, a curious expression on his dead face. He looked at the companions, then past the companions, and shook his head. That distant look made them all glance back to see Catti Bree standing down the hall, one hand extended, palm up, balancing a sapphire as the woman, scroll in hand, continued a soft, arcane chant.
"No,"
Puente growled, and it seemed as if he tried to come forward then, but could not, locked in place by the mounting Dwyamor of Catti Bree.
"No, ye dogs!"
He leaned forward then, toward their line, and he seemed to elongate, then to become something less than substantial. And he floated past them suddenly and swiftly, stretched and insubstantial, flowing into Catti Bree's waiting phylactery.
"Ye got him, girl!"
Brunner cried, starting her way, but he stopped even as he turned. Catti Bree trembled and shook her head as if something were very wrong. With only that unclear warning, the gemstone exploded into a million pieces, the concussion sending Catti Bree flying backward and flinging dust and pellets around the corridor. And there, where Catti Bree had been, where the gem had been, stood a very shaken Thibbledorf Puente.
"They got prisoners,"
he said to Brunner, fighting every word.
"And Treri's caught in a forge, and more there beside him, and a lady dwarf in the mines."
He stalked about a step to the left and back to the right, then dived back with startling speed and grabbed up the dazed Catti Bree by the throat.
"Could have killed ye,"
he whispered to her. And he dropped her there and leaped away, becoming a bat before he ever landed. He fluttered off the way he had come. Catti Bree pulled herself to her feet and reached up to pat at the blood on her face, blood from the cuts of a dozen shards of the burst gemstone.
"Me girl,"
Brunner said, rushing up to her as did the others. "I'm all right," she assured them, her gaze turning in the direction of Puente's retreat. "The gem was not sufficient to hold him."
"He's a monster,"
Regis whispered, the halfling thoroughly shaken by what he had seen in Puente's dead eyes.
"Half of one, perhaps,"
Catti Bree replied, and the fact that she was still alive and could reply bolstered her argument.
"Half and more, and the bad parts gaining," Brunner lamented. "Wilder than I seen him in the throne room them months ago."
"The curse,"
Catti Bree agreed.
"He cannot withstand it."
"They," Drizzt whispered, and all turned to him at that unexpected word.
Puente said they've got prisoners.
The drow explained to their curious expressions.
The drow got the forge then, from what he said and what we're knowing,
Brunner agreed.
And we might be needing to go through them to get to Puente again.
And to free Entreret.